Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll hear about a school district in northern Wisconsin that built the first K-12 fabrication lab in the state and how it's transformed the way kids are learning.
First, President Trump's remarks in Puerto Rico have become a PR challenge for the White House. The island territory was devastated by Hurricane Maria, and most of it remains without power.
During his visit, the president made comments about the severity of the disaster that some criticized as being tone deaf.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. And what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands.
The president followed up his visit to the U.S. territory with a stop in Las Vegas. The mass shooting there, which killed at least 59 people and injured over 500 others, has relaunched the national debate on gun control.
You can share your thoughts on either of those stories by calling now at 800-642-1234 in our weekly look at national news.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on Speaker Paul Ryan and House Republicans. Scott, welcome back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Well, Scott, can you recap yesterday's presidential visit to Puerto Rico? What happened?
Well, I think many people are calling it a bizarre, unconventional visit. Some might call it a PR disaster. There were several interesting storylines here. You mentioned a few of the comments that the president made, saying it was really nothing and not as bad as a real catastrophe like Katrina. I think a lot of Puerto Ricans and folks watching the Puerto Rico crisis unfold on TV were looking for sort of a healer in chief to visit the island to draw attention to the needs to learn more about what people actually do need in terms of food and water and electricity. We didn't really hear about any of that. There was a large focus on his dispute, the sort of war of words with the San Juan mayor, Carmen Yulin Cruz. President Trump, she's the woman who has been saying on national TV that people are dying here in Puerto Rico and the president is not doing enough to help. At the roundtable, televised roundtable hosted by President Trump, the mayor was invited, but he did not single her out for any praise, even though he singled out most people around the table for praise, and did not let her speak at this roundtable, even though she has sort of become the face of the Puerto Rico crisis. So there were a number of very interesting developments during the course of this several-hour visit. Of course, the lasting image we have is of the president passing out paper towel rolls to some folks, and it looked as if he was shooting the paper towel rolls into a crowd as if he were shooting a basketball. It was a very bizarre thing to watch.
How would you compare that visit to the president's response to the hurricanes in Florida and Houston?
I think he got fairly good remarks after his visits to Florida and Houston. Of course, he was with a number of Republican lawmakers from those regions. There weren't any, gaffes that I can remember. That's why this visit to Puerto Rico seems so strange, is because he had been through this before and actually had seen some of his approval numbers rise based on the handling of these crises in the Houston region and South Florida region. So I think it left a lot of people scratching their head. Of course, and this is sort of what we've come to expect from the president. You never really know what to expect or what he's going to do at any given moment.
Let's take a closer look, if we can, to some of the references the president made to fiscal matters. He mentioned the amount of money the U.S. had spent on recovery efforts and aid to Puerto Rico. He also mentioned debt. Can you walk us through some of those remarks that he made?
Yeah, he made some comments in regards to wiping out, like we need to wipe out Puerto Rico's enormous debt. And, of course, this is an island, a U.S. territory that has been plagued for years and years by debt. The local economy is not doing well. And I think that stoked a lot of confusion. Some of his administration, his top administration officials today, had to sort of walk those comments back because, you know, we're talking about billions of dollars in debt, and you can't simply wipe that away. That would not be favorable to Republicans on Capitol Hill, who believe that you know they're willing to extend a hand to Puerto Rico, but they don't want to simply wipe that slate clean. The other dollar figure that we saw this week has to do with funding for these types of hurricanes that we saw in Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico, and the White House sent up to Capitol Hill a request of just about $30 billion of aid for those three regions. This would be money to help replenish the FEMA coffers that very soon, because of these storms, will go dry. And so there is a need to make sure that those coffers are full so that as FEMA begins to execute its plan to help these regions, they have enough money to draw from.
We're talking national politics now with Scott Wong, a senior staff writer at The Hill. And this week saw a horrific mass shooting in Las Vegas at a country music festival. And Scott, there have been various takes on this politically, mostly Republicans saying this isn't the time to be talking gun control. Democrats saying this is yet another reason to be talking gun control. Politically, what is the unfolding story there?
I think unfolding is the key word. In recent minutes, just at the last vote series, I was talking to a number of Republicans about this Las Vegas issue, specifically having to do with, this issue of bump stocks. These are the devices that the shooter in Las Vegas used to essentially turn his semi-automatic guns into fully automatic weapons. And that allowed him to discharge that many rounds very quickly in such a short amount of time, in such quick bursts of gunfire, and eventually allowed him to inflict as much damage as he done with about 58 or 59 dead and more than 500 people injured. So what we're hearing actually from some Republicans, a handful of Republicans on Capitol Hill, is that they're open to banning these devices known as bump stocks. That is a change of heart from, I think, what we had been hearing from Republicans in the immediate aftermath of that tragedy, where the two parties were sort of backing into their respective corners on the gun debate. Usually we hear Republicans say that they, you know, this is really a mental health issue and this has nothing to do with guns. Democrats, of course, and we saw Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman who was shot back in 2011. She stormed Capitol Hill a day after the event and said this has everything to do with guns. This is exactly why we need to have this gun debate and why Congress needs to take action on gun reforms to prevent more tragedies like this one. So there's a little bit of movement, and I think that's something that's different this time around compared with other tragedies regarding guns that we've seen in the past.
And as you said, some unfolding storylines going on politically there, bump stocks being one of them. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has also had this to say about the potential of gun legislation after Las Vegas.
Yeah, I think it's particularly inappropriate to politicize an event like this. It just happened within the last day and a half. It's entirely premature to be discussing about legislative solutions, if any.
So, Scott, in light of some movement here and maybe some areas of bipartisan agreement, is the majority leader changing his stance at all?
Neither the majority leader nor the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, have changed their view on gun control. They believe that this is not a gun issue, a gun matter. We heard Speaker Ryan earlier this week say there's, you know, oftentimes in these cases, these gunmen have a history of mental illness, and he believes that's the case this time, although there are still a lot of details about this individual that we don't know. And so, you know, that basically Speaker Ryan and Mitch McConnell over on the other side of the Capitol, they are ultimately the ones who control what goes to the House and Senate floors. And without any sort of buy-in from those two leaders, nothing is going to happen. That being said, like I said before, it's very interesting that we have seen, we saw the first member, Republican member of Congress today that I reported call for a ban on these so-called bump stocks. That was Bill Flores, actually conservative member of the GOP conference on the House side from the state of Texas. He was formerly the Republican Study Committee chairman, a very conservative individual. And I asked him if he himself owned guns, and he said he in fact did. So he's a gun owner from Texas, former chair of the Republican Study Committee, who is calling for a ban on bump stocks.
Scott Wong is with us now. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill, and we're rounding up the top stories from Washington this week.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress, if anything, in response to the shootings in Las Vegas? Do you want to see efforts limited or otherwise on gun control? Or do you think, like Senator McConnell, this is not the time to be talking about that? Also, what did you think of the president's remarks and reactions to the Puerto Rico hurricane relief effort? You can join us now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
We'll get to your questions in just a moment here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Right now, we're recapping the week's top stories with Scott Wong. He's a senior staff writer at The Hill.
You can join us at 800-642-1234. How do you think lawmakers should be reacting to the gun control debate right now? What did you make of Secretary of State Rex Tillerson's remarks on President Trump, as reported in July and earlier today? Call in now at 800-642-1234.
And let's take a caller now. We have Brian with us in Amro. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just heard that Mitch McConnell said that it's not time to talk about gun control or sensible regulation. When is the correct time? When, you know, some of his family members get slaughtered, or instead of 59 people getting killed, how about 259? Is that the right number? I mean, what are we waiting for?
Brian, thanks for that. And that is a perspective that some people are voicing right now. Other people saying, no, this is a time for thought and prayer. Politically, is there a right answer to this right now, Scott, or just the way Congress functions in terms of bringing up issues after a tragedy?
Well, I think Brian was mentioning or echoing, rather, a comment that we heard this week from Mark Kelly. Mark Kelly is the husband and the astronaut hero of and who is married to Gabby Giffords, the former congresswoman who was shot in a mass shooting back in 2011 in Tucson, Arizona. And Mark Kelly was basically speaking for Gabby Giffords and saying, you know, when is the time, if not now, just after 58 people were gunned down and murdered, and all they wanted to do was to enjoy some country music on a you know, beautiful fall night. And so this is a scene that we've seen before after mass shootings around the country in Tucson and Aurora in Orlando. What happens oftentimes is that the members of the House and the Senate will join together in a moment of silence and then back into their respective corners on the gun control issue. And usually not a lot gets done. Of course, We all remember what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary when the 21st graders and teachers were gunned down by a deranged individual in their own elementary school. Many people thought that was the moment that would propel Congress to take some kind of action. There was the Manchin-Toomey background check bill in the Senate that received 55 votes, but of course, everyone knows you need 60 votes to overcome a filibuster in the Senate, and so while it had a majority in the Senate, it fell short of the 60 and failed. And many people lost hope that if Congress could not come together as Republicans and Democrats after 21st graders were gunned down, then when could they ever come together on gun reform?
Thank you for that call, Brian. And one more quick call from Jim in Superior. Jim, hi.
Yeah, hi. My problem is that everybody keeps blaming inanimate objects. And I'm a gun owner. I own high-capacity magazines. I'm a sports shooter. I'm a hunter. Not once has any one of my guns or magazines or any of my ammo, for that matter, ever opened my gun case, loaded themselves, and fired at anything in any way, shape, or form. Yes, these are very tragic, horrible things that happen. These people are bad people. The people that are doing it are the bad people. The weapons have nothing to do with it. Now, bump stocks, just to add this in quickly, bump stocks do not make a weapon fully automatic. Bump stocks merely add the rate of fire increases. It still does not a fully automatic weapon.
Jim, thank you for your thoughts. Scott, anything else to add before we move on?
No, I would just say that Speaker Ryan noted that Congress last year passed a mental health illness bill sponsored by Tim Murphy of Pennsylvania that would add funding to help people with mental illnesses. But of course, here we are, 7 months later, and we are still facing another tragedy. The speaker said that bill is being implemented as we speak, and that's why we didn't see any noticeable difference. But again, Republicans are pointing to mental health illness funding as the way to prevent some of these tragedies.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And let's move on now and look at another story, which has been, in play for a little while since the summer, resurfacing now. An NBC News report said Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called the president, quote, a moron and considered resigning. And now Tillerson has been speaking out about that story. What has he said?
Tillerson held a press conference today and pushed back on this NBC News report, which basically said that earlier this summer he had called Trump a moron to some colleagues after a meeting in the Pentagon. It's an example of more turmoil within the Trump cabinet, I believe, and we have seen quite a bit lately with the resignation of Tom Price and other members of the cabinet under investigation. Tillerson and Trump have not always seen eye to eye, although they were close during the campaign. And Tillerson has come under some scrutiny for not having staffed up his State Department quick enough. Obviously, these are important roles, and the agency has seen some reduced funding and has not filled some key positions at Foggy Bottom, where the State Department sits, and around posts around the world.
Tillerson today, in speaking with the press, was very complimentary of the president. Said he hadn't been planning on leaving. He was committed to the president. Did not deny some of the more inflammatory remarks. But how would you say that their relationship, the president and Secretary of State, where does it stand right now?
I think it's very tenuous. If we look back at the past 7 months at the number of individuals, top individuals, who have been fired from this White House and from the cabinet, it's a very long list. It goes all the way back to Sean Spicer, the press secretary, and Reince Priebus, of your state, the former RNC chairman who was fired as chief of staff. Most recently, I would mention Tom Price, the former HHS secretary who came under scrutiny for taking private charter flights around the country and sort of mixing official business and personal business. at the taxpayers' expense. Another member of the cabinet, Ryan Zinke, because they've now fired Tom Price, or Tom Price has resigned. It's sort of a slippery slope because there are other members of the cabinet who also have used private jets for official business. And so there's an appearance, you know, it doesn't look good for the Trump administration, especially when Donald Trump is the guy who said, we're going to come to Washington and drain the swamp. Now he has key members of his administration who are billing taxpayers for the use of private jets and flying some of the top members of the Trump administration around the country. So there's an optics issue clearly that doesn't look good, and that's why we're seeing so many of these negative stories.
And Scott, one more quick story to touch on before we let you go. The Department of Justice released some memos about the rules underlying the appointment of relatives for the White House. What got revealed there?
Yeah, this was pretty surprising, actually. The Justice Department released this week a series of old, I would say decades-old memos concluding that presidents cannot appoint family members to political positions in the White House or in the administration. This was the case until this January when the Trump administration took over and a DOJ official basically overturned those memos. That paved the way for the appointments of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, Trump's daughter and son-in-law, to take positions in the White House. And it's created a big headache for his family members, given that they are now part of the White House. They're facing investigations and are under scrutiny, most recently for using private email accounts, perhaps for official business. And so there might have been a reason why in the past administrations had decided that they would not allow presidents to appoint their family members to key jobs.
Scott, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Scott Wong's a senior staff writer at The Hill, where he focuses on Speaker Paul Ryan and House Republicans, joining us there for our weekly look at the latest in national news. First, fabrication labs, or fab labs, have been popping up in public schools all over the state. The goal of these labs is to provide students a hands-on learning experience focused on skills relating to science, technology, engineering, and math.
Our next guest is part of the first K-12 fab lab in Wisconsin. Dr. Stephen Yar is the director of Fab Lab Three Lakes in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. How are you today?
I'm good. Well, let's start with the basics here, Steve. What exactly goes on at a fab lab?
Fab labs are places of innovation where students are encouraged, invited to come in and make things of meaning to themselves. So we bring our students in and they work through their problems using an engineering design process. And along the way, they make mistakes, and we help them correct those mistakes, or they correct those mistakes, and they learn that making mistakes is part of innovating, and they learn to work through it and develop self-efficacy.
And Steve, tell us about the gear. What do we see when we walk into the Fab Lab?
When you walk into the Fab Lab, you will see a room with computers, which is our design center. We have a number of different software packages the students have access to. And then if you walk into the lab itself where the making happens, you'll see lasers and 3D printers, and you'll see a mini mill and a vinyl cutter. And in our big machines area, you'll see a CNC router and a CNC plasma cutter.
Now, you had me at lasers there. I think I would have enjoyed school even more if I'd seen this kind of fancy gear. Do you see kids' eyes light up when they see this stuff and realize they get to try it out?
They do. Their eyes really light up. But what really makes their eyes light up is when they make something of meaning to themselves for the first time all by themselves and they realize they can do it. Those are the real golden moments for us.
And what kind of project have kids come up with?
We had one senior high student made a complete Settlers of Catan game with all the game pieces. Our first graders come in and design the world's most ultimate snowflakes. Our third graders have come in and made cribbage boards and then gone and played cribbage because there's a lot of counting with it. Other students have come in and constructed about a 5-foot-high robot, and this year they're going to give the robot sensor capabilities, so if the robot senses you're standing in its way, it'll have to decide what to do about that. All kinds of really unique and creative things.
And Steve, tell us how this Fab Lab and Three Lakes came to be. How did it get funded and built?
So I was teaching at UW-Stout in 2013, and right next door to where I was teaching was the Fab Lab at Stout. And through some conversations with people up in Three Lakes, they had a room that they had set aside. They knew they wanted to do something with it. And so the Fab Lab became what they wanted to do in the K-12, and I came up here to help them with that. So we opened up our doors in 2014 with classes at the high school level, classes at the junior high level, and we're adding more and more experiences for our elementary kids all the time.
Talking to Stephen Yar, director of Fab Lab Three Lakes in Three Lakes, Wisconsin, a K-12 lab where kids design stuff and build it using some pretty fancy high-tech equipment. So, Steve, you've touched on this a little, but talk about what students are learning through the process of designing and making everything from, as you said, snowflakes to a full Settlers of Catan game.
So the research is telling us that kids today are seeing their world as very highly structured by adults and very zero tolerance. And as we listen to our employers, they're telling us that they're looking to hire students with the 21st century skills of creativity, collaboration, communication, and critical thinking. And so what we do in our lab is invite the students to come in and problem solve. And so it's, for us, it's all about getting the kids to come in, problem solve, develop self-confidence to go out in the world and help companies take on moonshot projects or start their own companies. And indeed, if you go back to the Fab Foundation at MIT, their mantra is empowerment, education, problem solving, job creation, and invention. So we're helping kids move up that ladder of success.
I saw a brief video about the Fab Lab, and I think one of the students was saying he had tried, I don't know, dozens or scores of different materials to try to make a light for whatever his project was. So kids, really, they're just trying to achieve a goal and step by step getting past obstacles to it.
Yes, they are. One of the things that makes the Fab Lab different is In a traditional class, students might come in and be given the same pile of lumber and the same pile of plans and be told to build a birdhouse, and they would be judged on the fit of their corners and everything. Here in the Fab Lab, if a student comes in and says they wish to build a birdhouse, we look at them and say, wonderful, what kind of a bird do you want to build it for? And they tell us the bird, and then they go research how big the bird is, how big its nest is, what its nesting environment is, and they design a birdhouse appropriate for the bird and put it out in the environment and see if they actually get a bird to nest in it. So it's a very, very different focus here.
And I understand this is mainly for students from kindergarten through 12th grade, but can community members check it out too?
Good question. Thank you for asking. Absolutely they can. We are open from 5 till 9 every Tuesday and Thursday for members of the community.
And what kind of things have people done, non-students, there?
One of the groups that has come in and really made the lab their own, is the Three Lakes Model Railroad Club. They've been designing model railroad car interiors. They've been designing little buildings that you can't buy at the local choo-choo store. They've had just all kinds of fun.
Now, you're a kind of a trailblazer here. This was the first K-12 Fab Lab in the state, as I understand it. Are you getting visits from other schools now looking to replicate your success there?
Yes, we are. We're getting visits from a number of school districts. And in addition to that, we offer a 2-week course in the summer called Fab Lab 101 for teachers. This summer, we had 14 teachers from a number of different school districts come and take our training, and they're trying to set up their own labs.
And how are teachers taking this? It seems like that would be pretty fun for them, too.
In some cases it is. In some cases they're a little bit hesitant to get into the technology, and so we're trying to help them get into the technology in a very comfortable and exciting way. Other teachers are trying to understand how they take this technology and incorporate it, for example, in an English class, and we help them to understand that in describing their problem, there's a huge amount of power in just writing it out in a story and putting the context around their problem in a story, and then taking that context and that written description and bringing it in the Fab Lab and walking out with an actual physical artifact that solves the problem.
Well, Steve, briefly, eventually we're going to have kids who have had access to this, you know, starting in kindergarten all the way through senior year. Is that exciting to you to think, you know, kids will have 12 years of experience with this by the time they get out of school?
It is very exciting, and I cannot wait to see what some of those kindergarten, first, and second graders are going to do, because I know that we're going to be running to keep up with them, and that is a very, very exciting prospect.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That's Stephen Yar, director of Fab Lab Three Lakes in Three Lakes, Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about high-tech fabrication labs in Wisconsin schools.
Now, for the first time in its 98-year history, the American Legion will be led by a woman. And it turns out she's from Wisconsin.
Denise Rowan was recently elected National Commander of the American Legion. Commander Rowan, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
Well, first, tell us about the American Legion. What is its mission?
Oh, the American Legion has actually, we're founded on four pillars. And those four pillars involve taking care of our veterans and their families, taking care of our military personnel, which falls under national security, and their families. And our other two pillars are about Americanism and children and youth. The Americanism part of it, helping the citizens of this country understand what it means to be an American and giving back to our communities in our state and the country, and also taking care of the children of this nation. So this year, my theme for the American Legion is family first. And as you can tell, in those four pillars, it really is about taking care of families. We have the American Legion family, which consists of the American Legion. We have the American Legion Auxiliary, the Sons of the American Legion, and we have American Legion Riders. So within our American Legion family, we take care of each other. But then as it steps down onto our four pillars, we have taking care of our veterans, their families, the military personnel, their families. And then in reality, we feel like we're helping take care of our whole nation's families.
And as I understand it, in a lot of communities, the American Legion, it is part of that community, that family of veterans in a local community, but it goes beyond that. A lot of other people might gather, say, at the American Legion Hall.
Oh, yes. Legion Halls, one of the things I'm looking forward to this year is I'm asking Legion Halls to open their doors to the community and invite the community in so they can see all of the great work that we're doing within our communities. When I was in Texas, we have, and I know across the nation, we have city council meetings that may be taking place in Legion Halls. We have Boy Scout, Girl Scout troops that are meeting in our Legion Halls. We just have amazing things. And right now, of course, in Florida and Texas and in Puerto Rico also, we have Legion Post there. We have the Legion family is stepping up to invite the community in as they're trying to recover from this great disaster that they're going through. And not only Florida, Texas, and Puerto Rico, we also have American Legion posts down in Mexico, and they're recovering from the earthquakes that are going on down there. So the American Legion family is just there to help take care of the communities. We have Legion posts from, I know several of them from Wisconsin, sent truckloads of supplies down to Texas to help them recover, and they're now collecting things for Florida, as is other departments, other states across the nation, just helping each other out, because that's what a family does. We step in and take care of each other.
What was your path to becoming the National Commander of the American Legion?
Well, I started out in a post in Sun Prairie. It was post 333. Actually, it starts out a little bit before that. We lived in Marshall for a while, and a Marshall American Legion recruiter came to recruit my husband into the organization. And when I identified myself as an eligible veteran, they told me that I could join the auxiliary because women are part of the American Legion Auxiliary, not quite understanding, I think, that I was an eligible veteran for the organization. A couple years later, when we moved to Sun Prairie, I was welcomed into the American Legion post there with open arms. They put me into it's called the adjutant position, which is the person who takes the minutes at the meetings and fills out some paperwork and stuff. And through the Sun Prairie American Legion, I got more connected with the community, and that connection within the community helped me see all of the great work that our organization does. And then stepping forward into different leadership positions there in town. And then slowly we have county level and district levels within our department. Department and state is the same thing. And then I became a historian for the state of Wisconsin, their legion, and then slowly took on different leadership positions. And when I was the first female to be state commander in Wisconsin. And during that process, the national organization sort of took note of me, and Wisconsin endorsed me to be a candidate for national commander. And at that point, the national organization, there's a team of about 30 national leaders who start tracking and watching and working with those people that are endorsed by their states. And they put me in different leadership positions. I was chairman of the National Membership and Post Activities Committee here in Indianapolis, and then they made me chairman of the National Veterans Employment Education Commission, which works out of our Washington office, still volunteer work. And then they just sort of vet you in the process mm-hmm. and along the way, and then they said, okay, you're ready to be an official candidate for the position. It's 2 years worth of campaigning, and during those 2 years I visited 49 states plus Puerto Rico. I missed Hawaii, but I visited all 49 states. And during that process of campaigning, I get to know other Legionnaires across the United States. Plus, they get to know me. I get to learn about issues that are troubling veterans across the United States. And things, what is a concern for a veteran in Maine may be different for a veteran in Alaska, but we all work together. And then we went into convention in Reno, Nevada in August, and I was unanimously elected as national commander.
We're talking to the national commander of the American Legion, Denise Rowan from Wisconsin. And Commander Rowan, you went from, oh, yeah, you could join the auxiliary to state commander and then national commander. And now just recently we talked to the second female state commander here in Wisconsin. Is something changing in the way we think of veterans that we see? Oh, yeah. Women too.
I'm gonna take a step back. That post that originally came to recruit my husband, they actually have when I became state commander, they put a picture of me up in their hall with a sign above it that said, she could have been a member of this post. Oh, remember, man. Women are veterans too. But you know, really, the American Legion was founded back in 1919. Mm-hmm. And when we were founded, our founding fathers understood that a veteran was a veteran. And it didn't matter what their race or their gender or their religion was. Women were always welcome into the organization. And women could actually vote for national commander of the American Legion before they could vote for President of the United States. So we've always thought of a veteran as a veteran. And I really think times are just changing. You know, the whole role of women in society over the last 20, 30 years it's just grown to the fact that there are more women in the military now. It's just the times are changing. Women have been in leadership position in our organization for several years. As a matter of fact, in Wisconsin, I believe our first state vice commander was elected back in 1956. So, like I said, women have been in leadership positions. The position of national commander is very demanding, male or female. Basically, I think my schedule right now has me only being home for, well, actually, 22 days off and not necessarily at home. So it's a real demanding time to be in this position, but it's very rewarding. And the people that I get to meet and the history lessons I'm learning are just amazing as I meet veterans from across this nation and the battles that they've been in, the stories they have to share, the things that you would never, ever learn in a history book. I get to meet these people in person, and it's amazing.
Well, as you meet people around the country, what kind of concerns are they raising about challenges facing veterans and active duty military service members?
Well, we just had three major veterans bills that were just recently passed. And one of the big one is the Forever GI Bill, that the GI Bill eligibility would last a person's lifetime now. Accountability in the VA healthcare system. And the third one that we're really proud of was the Appeals Modernization Act, which President Trump actually signed on stage at our national convention, which, as my understanding, that's never happened before, that the president actually signed a bill on stage. Right now, we're concerned about military budgets to make sure that we have national security is one of our pillar, our main pillars, and we need to make sure that our military personnel have the resources they need to continue protecting our nation. And then, of course, there's terrorist stuff going on. There's a lot of U.S. citizens don't realize that we still have troops deployed. We have military personnel serving around the globe. And, you know, after 9/11, it was all over the news, but that's sort of slowing down. And now, of course, we have our concerns about what's going on over in North Korea. We actually have a Wisconsin unit of the Air Guard over in North Korea right now. And I'm looking forward, right now I'm scheduled to go over on a Far East tour in the end of November. And we're hoping that we can hook up with some of the Wisconsin troops that are over there and just give them our support and let them know how much we care about them.
When people talk about, say, the World War II era, and that's something that affected everybody. If you didn't serve, you had somebody close to you who served, you had somebody in your family who served. People talk about a distance between the civilian population and active duty military and veterans now, because a lot of people don't know someone who is serving or who has served recently. How do you bridge that kind of culture gap, I guess, between people who have that connection to the military and people who don't?
You know, it's surprising with the National Guards across the nation, and because we're there in Wisconsin. When you're in a community, you would be surprised. There are people's next door neighbors who may be having a family member who's deployed, or a relative, or a coworker. There are members of the military who are deployed in small communities across this nation. It's just an awareness issue. Like I said, my theme is family first. So one of the things I'm trying to bring awareness to is get to know your military personnel who live in your community. Get to know there's a piece of protection there, and part of national security is making sure that as our military personnel are deployed, that someone's here at home helping take care of their families, and their school systems. We have kids in our local school systems who have somebody who may be deployed from their communities, and we're doing our best to make sure the teachers in those schools know. But it's just that it's an awareness issue, and it's also a national security issue also, and it's a security issue for the families, because the families need to make sure they're taken care of, and the families need to make sure they're protected. I know the news crews are always there when we have deployments going on, and the news crews are there when the troops come home. But the American Legion family is there in the middle of that. They're there for the goodbyes. We're here for the hellos, but we're also there for that all that time in between to make sure that everybody's taken care of in between that time. I'm going to add this too. Legion.org has so much information about our organization. And if anybody who ever felt like they weren't welcome at the Legion, or they just want to check us out, please stop by a Legion post, check us out, or go to our website and check that out also.
Commander Rowan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
That was Denise Rowan of Wisconsin. She was recently elected National Commander of the American Legion. She's the first woman to be elected to the top position of that 98-year-old organization. Previously, she was the first woman elected to lead the Wisconsin chapter of the American Legion. And you can look on the WPR.org website for an interview with her successor, the second woman to run that organization in Wisconsin.
Today is our favorite kind of day. It's an excuse to eat random yummy food. Today, that food is the taco.
Today, October 4th, is National Taco Day. It's not really possible to be anti-taco. They're good, and you could do anything with them, just about. And Americans agree. Apparently, we ate 4.5 billion tacos last year. That's according to the National Taco Day website. I have not personally confirmed that count.
And most of those tacos eaten were you.
Right, well, about 1.5 billion.
Yeah, well, my family's already planning to eat veggie fajitas, kind of close to the taco, but it does make one want to celebrate this delicious food. Do you have a favorite taco?
I got a lot of my go-to at home is the chicken in the crock pot with salsa, and that's it. I mean, you can make it fancier than that, but you let that sit all day and throw it on taco shells, and it's great. I love it, and it's super easy.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I think I tried that once at your suggestion. It was pretty, I remember being pretty
easy. It's hard to screw up, which is important to me.
And I like what you call hippie tacos. I like the fried avocado taco and portobello tacos.
Portobello
mushrooms. Yeah. Yeah.
And we were talking fish tacos. I've never made those. I'd love having them in restaurants. So that's the tilapia we were talking, easy fish. Again, hard to screw up. That's a good one to try at home.
Deep question for the day. Is there anything that you can't put in a taco? I think you can put pretty much anything in
like
a taco.
Twinkies?
Twinkie taco. That sounds good.
I wouldn't eat that.
Sure you would.
I probably would.
I think you would.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.